Welcome to the third episode of the Post-Truth Politics podcast, recording at the Arena Center for European Studies in the University of Oslo. I'm Asmina Mikhailidou, digital media researcher and host of today's episode. Joining me today through video link, all the way from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, is Associate Professor Lucas Graves. Welcome, Lucas.
Thank you, Asmina.
Thank you very much for joining me. We'll be discussing today, well, what fake news is exactly and how much of a danger it poses for our democratic societies in Europe and beyond. And Lucas, you are at the forefront of research on fact-checking journalism. Your work has been supported by the American Press Institute, the Poynter Institute, the Duke Reporters Lab, the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism, and you have also developed a live fact-checking site and a journalism curriculum built around that together with your colleague Michael Wagner, with support by the Baldwin Idea Grant. So to begin with, what is it that fact-checking sites are battling against? What is fake news?
I'm actually a bit uncomfortable with that term. I mean, there's been a lot of debate among academics and people interested in information policy about whether we should even be using a term that has been effectively co-opted by many politicians as a way to discredit journalism in general. But the narrowest definition, given that I think we've sort of lost that battle, clearly the term is still out there, even academics are using it, researchers are using it. I think the narrowest definition of fake news would be misleading content, which is masquerading as legitimate journalism. So there are many varieties of misinformation and disinformation out there in the world. We run across this all the time on the internet, everything from chain emails, you know, with ridiculous rumors that some relative forwards to us, to sites that look like they might be legitimate purveyors of news, but in fact are not. And I think that that's what the term was originally used to describe. And that's still probably the most accurate definition, although it's used very inconsistently, right? Many, even among researchers, even among academics, sometimes it refers to misinformation in general. Sometimes it's used more narrowly.
So I was actually going to ask you next, what is the difference between misinformation and disinformation? So if we move away from the fake news term that seems to be a catch-all phrase, like you said, what is the difference between the other terms then?
This also can be a complicated question. A really good reference is the taxonomy of misinformation and disinformation that was put together a few years ago by Claire Wardle at First Draft. And that runs all the way from sort of satire or parody on one end, which is, you know, humorously false information, which is not actually intended to deceive people, all the way to fabricated content at the other extreme. I won't run through all of the categories. But in general, misinformation is inaccurate information that has the potential to mislead people, to make them believe things that aren't true. Whereas disinformation is deliberately, misinformation that's deliberately distributed. In other words, it's used strategically in order to misinform the people who are exposed to it, and in order to achieve some commercial or political goal.
So the difference is, you know, in the intention behind what is distributed in a way.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And I would say, by the way, that often when we refer to misinformation, we mean to encompass disinformation. So we might refer to all misinformation broadly, including both sort of intentional and not intentional false content, because very often we can't tell, you know, what the reasons are why it's produced, whether it's intended to misinform. But when we speak about disinformation, we are making a claim that we know that it's been manufactured deliberately in order to deceive.
So having firsthand experience of fact-checking through your research, could you tell us a bit more about fact-checking as a way to tackle fake news? So how is it different from what journalists have been traditionally doing in their work?
That's a great question. You know, fact-checking has a really interesting history in journalism. And of course, every journalism, you know, the fundamental commitment of journalism is faithfulness to the facts. Every journalist should be concerned above all else, with making sure that the information that they share is accurate. But in the last couple of decades, we've seen a movement towards what I sometimes call external fact-checking, to distinguish it from that traditional internal fact-checking that's always been a part of journalism, at least in good newsrooms. The difference is that internal fact-checking is focused on making sure that the information in an article or any other text is accurate before you publish it, right? So you're trying to eliminate the mistakes before you put the text out there in the world. Whereas external fact-checking focuses instead on publicly refuting information which is already public. And that could be, you know, a chain email that has false rumors. It could be an item of fake news, or it could be a political claim, something that a politician says that turns out not to be true. And journalists have increasingly embraced this role, both in the United States and around the world, since the mid-2000s. And more recently, a lot of fact-checking sites have turned their attention specifically to fake news. This is partly because there's been so much concern around fake news circulating online since 2016. So there's been a lot of public attention to fake news and a lot of funding available to try to fight the circulation of fake news. A lot of fact-checking sites have partnered with Facebook in order to, so they're paid by Facebook in order to debunk, you know, false posts that are circulating on the platform. But so, you know, in general, these fact checkers practice two different kinds of work. They're quite different. Checking political claims involves a different kind of research. Sometimes it's more complicated, requires more effort than just debunking a fake post about a false coronavirus cure. But they increasingly take on both of these missions.
So if I hear you correctly, it means also that journalists perhaps need more resources to do this kind of fact checking, and that other actors need to come in and support this effort? Or is it something that journalists can do on their own?
It's definitely a time-consuming and resource-intensive kind of journalism. So sometimes checking a political claim, a false political claim, might take a day or 2 days or maybe even an entire week of a journalist's time, because you have to call all of the authoritative sources, muster the evidence, and then analyze it. And sometimes these claims are quite nuanced, right? So there might be a claim about the economy or about unemployment or about science. And it requires real research to figure out where the truth lies and to assemble that in a way that's clear for the reader. So this is a resource-intensive kind of journalism. The, you know, news industry in general, both in North America and around the world, you know, is in hardship right now. You know, advertising and subscriptions have been threatened. There's a lot more competition for readers' attention and viewers' attention. So it is hard for resource-constrained organizations to do fact-checking without outside support. The landscape of fact-checkers around the world includes everything from traditional commercial news organizations like, you know, newspapers like the New York Times or the Washington Post, to nonprofit groups or civil society organizations that rely entirely on foundation support or on public donations in order to fight misinformation.
So would you say that all these different actors you just described are part of what you have called in your 2016 book, Deciding What's True, The Rise of Political Fact-Checking in American Journalism? You talk about the emerging news ecosystem, right? And fact-checking journalists are key actors in this ecosystem. So could you tell us a little bit more about who else is part of this ecosystem first?
Yeah, so that's a term that people who study news on the internet or news in the digital age really love, that term ecosystem, because it gets at the complexity of a landscape where we have many different types of news organizations and of other actors kind of participating in, you know, in public discourse and producing work that, whether it's professional or not, you know, resembles news. So beginning in the early 2000s, you had the rise of bloggers who were not, you know, paid journalists. They were amateurs, but in many cases, they were very involved. They were doing original reporting. They're very involved in the the public conversation around the news of the day. You have aggregation sites that would pull together news from other sources and recontextualize it. You have investigative nonprofits, sites like ProPublica. You have the rise of many more partisan news organizations. You know, of course, those already existed, but they've really flourished on the internet. In the United States, that's sites like Breitbart on the right. And yeah, in addition to that, you have fact-checking groups practicing a very specialized kind of journalism. So the information landscape has become much more varied in a way, much more specialized, much more interesting. All these outlets work in relation to each other. And we've seen, especially since 2016, we've seen partisan divisions increasingly harden in terms of people's patterns of consuming information online. And we've also seen increasingly the rise of fake news sites, whether for political purposes or because, you know, as a sort of revenue generating strategy, take advantage of this information ecosystem in order to disseminate false information.
So I was actually going to ask you about that. So ties in nicely with my next question, which is, so this news ecosystem, if we can tie it to the political dimension of the public sphere, so could you tell us if and how it has been affected by the past 4 years in particular of the Trump presidency, for example, in the US? And I ask this because, you know, it's really interesting for our listeners to get an understanding of how news ecosystems and political ecosystems interact.
Well, I think that partisan divisions have really hardened. And we've also seen, you know, just a lot more energy poured into disseminating false information. I don't want to exaggerate that. You know, anyone who's used the internet, you know, knows that beginning in the 1990s, it's been a rich source of information of questionable veracity. And you have very rich online subcultures that have sort of different forms of joking and of myth-making. And a lot of fake news emerges from those subcultures, places like Reddit and 4chan. But arguably, beginning in 2015 and 2016, around events like the US presidential election or the Brexit referendum in the UK, you saw this production of false information really mature in a way. So we saw the emergence of sites that realized that in a partisan environment, they could reliably generate viral stories by crafting fake news that would tap into people's partisan attitudes, right? So it's a way to really monetize these existing political rifts in different societies. And once, you know, once people saw how successful that was, then many more, you know, there were many imitators.
So, but then if I take it to another step forward time-wise, so if we come to the current COVID-19 crisis, right, it's a global health crisis first and foremost. And here we have the World Health Organization talking about an infodemic that is developing, right, in parallel with a health crisis. And I was wondering, because a health crisis, a pandemic, is not perhaps as obvious a ground for partisan divisions to emerge, right? So what is it here? And I mean, you've written about this. What would you say are the key elements that have turned such a global health crisis into an infodemic?
So one element is just the complexity of that information ecosystem itself, right? There aren't gatekeepers in the way that there once were. In many ways, that's a good thing. We have much more open sort of political, you know, landscapes of political discourse today because we don't have a handful of sort of establishment outlets that constrain public discourse. But the cost of that is that it's harder to weed out bad information. So that's kind of the fertile ground for the spread of misinformation. But along with that, you have rising partisanship and declining trust in news organizations and in other public institutions, including science, right? Including universities, including the academy. And I'd actually contest the idea that scientific questions aren't fertile ground for partisanship, because when you have a climate in which people are afraid and in which there are very high stakes public political debates taking place about what the best course of action is, right? Do we go for herd immunity? Do we need mask mandates? Is that an infringement on personal liberty? Should children go back to school or not? That's an extremely fertile climate for misinformation to take root, because people are afraid, because people are concerned, because the stakes are so high. And so that adds a political charge to what would otherwise be just scientific questions. And I would say one more factor is the complexity of science itself, right? Science is often an area where people who seek to misinform or who seek to disinform can take advantage of the nuance of scientific work, of time that it takes to produce scientific consensus. They can take advantage of that and highlight findings that don't fit the mold or highlight preliminary research. We've seen many examples of that during the infodemic around COVID-19, when some study that hasn't yet been peer-reviewed has been trumpeted as being definitive and used in a way that it shouldn't be used in public. So this is really, in a way, it's a perfect storm for misinformation and disinformation.
But is there anything we can take away from this crisis as a lesson for how to build and keep citizens' trust towards news media, even when we have this perfect storm unfolding?
I think there is some hopeful news that's emerged around this sort of crisis. We've seen subscriptions to established news organizations, to reliable professional news organizations, are up in the United States, certainly during the pandemic. We saw a similar surge in 2016 at the height of the election, when many people were waking up to the reality of a Trump presidency. There is evidence that in moments of crisis, people turn to news, people seek reliable information sources. There's an interest in news. In a way, tuning the news out is a luxury of, peaceful times or moments of relative prosperity and lack of concern. Now, it's still the case that many news organizations are going to do well with sensationalism and with partisanship. So I don't think there's any way to sort of put that genie back in the bottle. But we also see that others do quite well commercially by leading with the facts. And I think that in terms of restoring trust, the first step is to just do good journalism, practice transparency, be open with errors and mistakes, focus on increasing the public's understanding of what it takes to produce sound and unbiased journalism. I think, there are biases in journalism, but a lot of people really have unrealistic ideas about how easily reporters let their sort of personal biases affect their work. In fact, it means something to be, to have a career as a reporter and to make a good faith effort to approach stories with an open mind. And you see evidence of that in the work of good news organizations.
That's quite encouraging. Then it's not all doom and gloom in a way. There is hope, as you point out. But I'm curious about your view on whether this fake news phenomenon is the, let's say, the chicken or the egg in the problem, in the sense that many point to the US as a prime example of how things go wrong between news and politics, right? They point out that fake news is not the cause of a malfunctioning democratic system, but the symptom of existing weaknesses in this particular democratic system. But what we see is that misinformation is taking hold in public spheres with very long traditions of trustworthy news media sources and stable democratic systems like the Nordic countries. So the question is it digitalization then the root of the problem and not fake news as such?
I don't think so. Or at least, you know, I think that the search for sort of black and white causes, and even approaching this in a sort of cause and effect perspective, misses the bigger point. Certainly, digitalization has created an information environment in which purveyors of false information can thrive, but they thrive because of political divisions. And even in stable, you know, relatively well-off Western European democracies with strong welfare states, there are still strong political divisions that are there to exploit, right? Globalization has, and you know, migration patterns and the question of how to fund welfare states into the future. There are high stakes political questions and debates that are ripe for exploitation in all of these countries, in all of these societies. So I think it's overly simplistic to say, well, along came the internet and then that caused fake news and fake news eroded our democracies. I agree that in general, fake news is more of a symptom than a cause. And the underlying cause would be the potential for declining trust in public institutions. And you have seen some evidence of not the abysmally low levels of trust that we have in the United States, but of declining trust and increasing partisanship, even in some Western European democracies. And you know, ultimately, I would argue that if you wanted to look for root causes, I would point to something like inequality much sooner than I would point to something like the internet, right, or digital technology.
So then how much of a threat is fake news or misinformation to democracy in the end?
I don't think fake news is the threat. I mean, if I look at the situation in the United States, which I agree is quite, you know, is fairly dire and really worrying. And we've seen the erosion of democratic norms and democratic institutions. And I think it's, again, you know, I think we can't attribute that to the effects of false information. I think we have to look for deeper structural causes. And again, as you said yourself, fake news is more of a symptom than a cause. And in the United States, in particular, I think the political crisis is so severe precisely because we've had political dysfunction for so long. We've had parties that, especially on the right, but not only on the right, have pursued their own political advantage, short-term political advantage, with a strategy of deliberately increasing partisan division, right? Increasingly turning towards kind of winner-take-all politics in which members of the opposing party are seen as, you know, not as legitimate competitors, but as threats to the, you know, the American way of life or something like that. And of course, all that is reinforced by geographic and cultural sorting and in a very profound way by longstanding patterns of structural racism. And if you wanted to look for the roots of the crisis in the United States, you know, it would make sense to look, for instance, to the 1960s when you had a big political, 1950s and 1960s, when you had a sort of political realignment and the Republican Party increasingly became the party of sort of aggrieved whites, frankly. And you saw an increase in sort of politics of exclusion and politics of vilification. So those are the kinds of sort of explanation that I tend to favor rather than just the rise of a new technology. But certainly that new technology is part of the story, right? I mean, those are the resources that are exploited for these political ends.
So perhaps it's more like an amplifying factor in, you know, that has enabled problems that were pre-existing to perhaps spread faster or have a greater impact rather than causing the problems itself.
Yeah, I think that's right. And in general, I think when we look at complex questions like this, we rarely see, it's always a chicken or egg question, right? It's always a process. It's almost always overly simplistic to speak of one decisive cause.
To go back to what you touched upon earlier, so the same way we can't really perhaps blame digital technologies for all the ills that have befallen the public sphere, perhaps we could also look at signs of resilience of the democratic public sphere that are facilitated or amplified through digital technologies, like to resist the infodemic crisis or misinformation and so on.
I think that's absolutely true. And, you know, it's remarkable to me, and, you know, both personally and in the sort of wider conversation, how quickly we have all abandoned the optimism, in some cases utopianism, that attended these technologies just 10 years ago, right? When we saw the internet and digital media in general as a way to open up political conversation, as a way to increase participation, as a way to challenge often insulated elites. Right. It was all of those things. All of that happened. And in many ways, that was good. That was healthy. And we can't forget that, even as we now find ourselves wishing that those, you know, elites had some of the authority that we used to question just 10 or 15 years ago. I mean, I was much happier in a world where I was mainly criticizing the New York Times for the coverage I thought it was, you know, neglecting, than a world where I find myself always defending the New York Times because you need some pillar of credible information, right?
So in all these years, you have been researching the challenges that digital networks perhaps pose to established media and political institutions. Has there been anything in your findings that has really surprised you?
I mean, absolutely. Not to repeat myself, but what we were just talking about is, I think, the biggest surprise. When I was in, you know, graduate school and first getting interested in the sort of systematic scholarly study of digital media and politics and, you know, journalism in the emerging news ecosystem, you know, it was easy to believe that the internet was in general a force for openness, a force for transparency, a force for good that would have a salutary effect on journalism. You know, we pointed to things like Wikipedia and WikiLeaks as powerful vectors for reinvigorating civil society, again, for challenging public corruption and insulated, you know, insular elites, self-serving elites. So I've been surprised by how quickly sort of events took a different turn and challenged that optimistic read. For that reason, we have to be equally cautious about embracing dystopian visions. It's only been, if we think of the beginning of this crisis as being, you know, sort of the public discussion of this crisis, this sense of crisis as being 2015 or 2016, it's only been a handful of years, right? So we have yet to see exactly how resilient democracy in the United States and elsewhere will be. Now, certainly there's cause for concern. There's even cause for alarm, I would argue, and long-term weaknesses have been exposed. You know, our reliance on elite norms that were so quickly abandoned has been really exposed, but history will continue to surprise us. So I think it's far too early to say that this spells the end of the democratic experiment.
It's great to have such an optimistic outlook on this crisis?
I'm not usually accused of that. I mean, I want to say, I hope it's not an unrealistic optimism. I'm just saying that we, you know, the story's not over yet.
Well, I would tend to agree with you on this. In the sense that, technology is neutral and it's what we make of it. And at the same time as we see, yes, infodemic and intentional spreading of lies, harmful lies even, we also see signs of resilience. And I actually wanted to ask you about this a little bit more to see if you can identify if there's anything that you think other democracies can learn, because so far we've tended to just point the finger at the US as an example to avoid, right? But I wanted to know if there's anything that other democracies can learn from the way fake news is currently being tackled in the US.
I mean, I'm not going to surprise anybody here. I think that the structural advantages and the sources of resilience in the information ecosystems in Western Europe, even in the UK, have been made quite clear in these years. And that is reliable funding for public sector media. Now, I know that's a live debate in many countries, but I think we've seen the advantages of having an institution like the BBC that at least acts as an anchor for public discourse. And though, it is constantly attacked politically from both the left and the right, in general, it acts as a center of gravity that prevents the kind of polarization of the media landscape in terms of audience behaviors that we see in the United States. And the same is true in elsewhere in Europe. Beyond that, a good model is the approach that the public sector takes in investing in science, right? The idea is that it may be commercial interests that wind up bringing a new discovery to market, but the role of government, the role of the state, is to create an environment that supports that and to invest in long-term, in sort of basic research that opens up new areas of development. Similarly, I think the role of the state is to create the conditions for a vibrant and open civil society by investing in public sector media and by resisting the erosion of pluralistic, of laws that support pluralism and open public discourse. One important step there would be to avoid overreacting to the crisis around fake news or the perceived crisis around fake news with laws that overly inhibit public debate.
Yeah, there's a fine balance to be maintained there, exactly. On a personal level, someone is listening to this and thinking, well, I'm not a journalist, I'm not an expert, I'm not a politician. What can I do about this, in my daily life? So do you have any tips about how we can all deal with misinformation in our daily life?
I mean, I think the trick is to be sort of skeptical without being cynical. What I find useful in my own kind of information consuming habits is to question anything that sort of pulls me, that makes me want to immediately share it, or that sort of provokes an emotional reaction. And it's, sometimes, very often, accurate news provokes that reaction. But still, that's when your, awareness should be heightened, and you should at least consider, is there some other way to look at this event? If I didn't have my sort of political views, how might I understand this? And what am I achieving by sharing this? Is it just satisfying an emotional impulse, or am I actually contributing to, to a conversation? Is there some consensus that I'm hoping to establish or to promote by sharing this information? I think we should be guided. We should have a kind of civic mindset in our information seeking and sharing behavior. And that sometimes means, you know, resisting our emotional impulses.
And perhaps also some self-reflection about our own motives and what, getting into the other person's shoes perhaps could also help.
That's, you know, hugely important. And it doesn't mean that political differences don't matter, and it doesn't mean that you abandon your convictions. It just means that you take a moment to reflect. That's difficult. You know, arguably one shift of, you know, the rise of the kinds of the digital ecosystem that we live in today is that it's harder to find those spaces for reflection. Certainly it can feel that way sometimes. So we have to create them, and we have to practice a kind of self-discipline, arguably, that cultivates those habits of reflection.
So as our very insightful conversation draws to a close, there's one more question I'd like to put to you. Fake news is a global phenomenon, and it feeds off the way that we're all interconnected globally. But would you say that professional journalism is or has the potential or is moving towards a similar direction of global solidarity and collaboration to tackle fake news and therefore regain people's trust?
I would absolutely say that. And you've, you know, with your last question, you've hit on the area that I'm most sort of avidly interested in right now, which is the global spread of fact-checking as a movement in a very organized way, right? So you have conferences where fact-checkers from around the world get together and share strategies for fighting fake news and share, you know, jointly seek funding sources and are really driven by a sense of mission. In, you know, this is among organizations working in very different political contexts, right? You have journalists from the US and from France and from South Africa and from Southeast Asia getting together with civil society groups, with activists, with academics in a way that is trying to jointly combat the spread of false information. And they collaborate very actively day to day in sharing information about fake news that crosses borders, right? Because often these rumors, you know, they don't stay in one place. They spread, they're reproduced, they evolve across national lines, like a virus does, hence the power of the infodemic metaphor. And so, yeah, I'm very heartened by that. And it really parallels what we've seen with investigative journalism through efforts like the ICIJ and these large-scale global collaborations where journalists get together to conduct joint investigations that are vastly more impactful than anything they could do alone. I think that's the most hopeful. I think that kind of collaboration, the sort of, you know, journalism without borders, is the most hopeful, you know, note in journalism today.
Fantastic. I really like to close on a positive note. So thank you very much, Lucas, for offering such great insights into the fake news challenge, or I should say misinformation challenge. This was Lucas Graves, a fact-checking journalism and open source movement expert, discussing the effects of fake news on the US and global politics for episode 3 of our Post-Truth Politics podcast. I'm Asimina Mikhailidou, your host for today. Thank you for tuning in and welcome back to our next episode when I talk to award-winning investigative journalist Aris Hadzistehanou.